The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie doke. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, Sunday, April 27th, 2003. We just had a wonderful, successful, victorious war in Iraq. At least that's what we're being told. And now comes the aftermath and then on to the next victory. Today we're going to be talking about the press coverage of the Iraq War, the buildup, what's taking place now, the occupation and the aftermath, and what we learn from the media coverage and what we don't learn from the media coverage and what we should know about it that we may not know. We're very privileged to have as our guest today on Media Matters, Reese Ehrlich, who's been a journalist for 35 years, and he currently works as a full-time freelance correspondent and radio producer. His newspaper pieces have appeared in numerous papers in the U.S. and around the world, and he reports regularly for a variety of radio networks, including NPR, the CBC, the World, and Common Ground Radio. He's also the producer of award-winning radio documentaries, and most recently the author, along with Norman Solomon, a guest on this program, of the book called Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. Welcome to Media Matters, Reese Ehrlich.
Well, thank you very much, Bob.
I really appreciate your joining us. And, yeah, let's get right down to it. You've been to Iraq, as I understand it, several times in the past few years and have been covering this story very closely and also been covering how the story has been played in the news media. And just opening question, how do you think the U.S. news media performed in covering the war in Iraq?
First, just a real quick correction. I visited Iraq once September of last year, although I've covered the Middle East for many years and been to the region many times. I think, frankly, you know, the media, in the mainstream media now, New York Times, CNN, et cetera, are patting themselves on the back for what a great job they've done and how well the embedded reporters did, and they did 24/7 coverage. And basically, I think we've gotten more coverage and more live coverage than in any war in history, and gotten less real information. I think that by and large, most of the mainstream media coverage was stenography and cheerleading for the Pentagon. All we need to do is look at the issue of weapons of mass destruction. Every day, the Pentagon or CIA or somebody leaks new information to the New York Times, to CNN, claiming that they finally found the weapons of mass destruction. And every day, they report based solely on the assertions of the U.S. government, with no independent verification or even attempt to do so, that they finally found them. And then the following day, or two or three days later, it turns out, well, actually, they weren't weapons of mass destruction. They were pesticides or something like that. But each day, then they proceed to produce the next one as if none of this had ever happened before. There's no skepticism. And now, of course, the latest information out of the White House, according to the New York Times, is that, well, maybe the Iraqis didn't have weapons of mass destruction. All they had were the precursors. Of course, undercutting the entire justification for the war, which is that Saddam Hussein was an immediate threat because of these horrible weapons of mass destruction that he had that he was ready to use. So, you know, it's like the White House's for presentation on this is appalling, and the fact that the mainstream media goes for hook, line, and sinker is even more appalling.
Now, let's touch on this another develop this a little bit further, because I think the point is of extraordinary significance. I mean, as I understood it, the entire legal justification for the U.S. attack in Iraq, there might have been moral justification, some might argue, but the legal one was, in fact, that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction and therefore was working to deliver them against the U.S., and the U.S. therefore had a right to invade, to neutralize, or to take out the ability of the Iraqis to attack the U.S. with these weapons. Is that correct?
Yeah, sure. And they remember the constant harping on the violations of U.N. resolutions, and the key UN resolutions that they always cited were the fact that they had to eliminate their weapons of mass destruction. And since they hadn't done it, the U.S. was justified in invading. Of course, the fact that nobody else in the world believed the United States, that was a minor detail, that the U.S. couldn't get the U.N. to go along with it. But yes, you're absolutely right.
But
that was the legal justification.
Before the war actually began and the U.S. invasion commenced, what was the nature of the evidence that had been provided to prove the case of the U.S. up to that point, and how well had that material been criticized in the U.S. news media?
Well, the argument was, and if you your listeners recall Colin Powell's famous speech before the UN, in which he had maps and charts, and he was praised on the day of the presentation by all of the major media in this country, New York Times et al., Washington Post, etc., and he purported to show, you may recall the secret poison lab in this area held by a group of right-wing fundamentalists in northern Iraq that was somehow in league with Saddam Hussein. He showed trucks that were used supposedly mobile weapons labs, underground bunkers full of chemical weapons. I mean, you know, in great voluminous detail. There was only not to mention the purchase of uranium, so-called yellow cake from Niger, that proved that Saddam Hussein was involved in restarting his weapons, his nuclear weapons capability. All of these things were cited in great detail. There was only one small problem. Whenever international inspectors went to check out any of these claims, in every single case, it turned out to be false. And the most blatant one was this yellow cake from the country of Niger. The U.S. had these documents. They refused to show them to anybody else. They cited it, President Bush cited it in his State of the Union message as proof of the evilness of Saddam Hussein because he's developing nuclear weapons. When the weapons inspectors from the UN actually had a chance to look at these documents within hours and using very sophisticated intelligence gathering methods, they went on Google and they did a search. It turned out that the guys who signed the letter wasn't even in power on the date that the letter was written. Or purportedly written. So it was an obvious forgery that anybody could have figured out, but it had been the whole basis for the claims about nuclear weapons. So basically, the U.S. was making it up as they went along. They took the flimsiest of evidence, or no evidence whatsoever, blew it up into a massive case. And now they're in essence admitting that, because they're now saying that the U.S., in fact, the Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction in the sense of having weaponized chemical or biological weapons. They may have had, they're hoping they can find precursors, or maybe they'll find a scientist who once thought about making a chemical weapon, but, you know, it's absolutely appalling. And then the U.S. government wonders why the rest of the world is so critical and so fed up with the United States, because it's okay here, apparently, in the U.S., as long as you win, it doesn't matter what justification you used for it at the time. And there's a massive, as far as the mainstream media is concerned, this kind of massive amnesia that goes on, which is, well, as long as we've won, it doesn't really matter what the justification for the war is, because everybody here loves it, and therefore we don't have to probe too deeply. I'm waiting for the big investigative story on the front page of the New York Times that exposes the fallacies of all of the arguments of the Bush administration, but I think I'm going to be waiting a long time.
And ideally, those sort of points would come out before you actually engage in a war, spend a fortune, get lots of people, most of whom innocent and none of whom deserve to die, dying, not in a post-mortem after the war.
Yeah, one would hope. All we have to do is look at what's happening in Afghanistan now to know what's likely to be happening in Iraq.
Well, actually, that's a good point, because it's hard to know what's happening in Afghanistan, because it really sort of fallen off the news map.
Well, there's another good example. By the way, I don't think there's a conspiracy on behalf that there's a backroom deal of a cabal of White House aides sitting in the back rooms of the White House and then phoning up the editors of the New York Times and CNN, who in turn relay what should be reported to the reporters. I think it's a much more sophisticated system than that. The reporters and the editors put their fingers to the wind to see which way the political winds are blowing, and don't report certain things or downplay certain things or poo-poo certain things if they perceive it to be too far outside of the political consensus in Washington. And so you have censorship effectively without anybody in the government and dark sunglasses having to look over the shoulders of the guys writing the stories. But Afghanistan is a perfectly good example. I was there in January of last year. I reported extensively on the chaos that was Afghanistan.
Now, let's back up one second and put this in context for listeners who might not be up to speed on this issue. I mean, what has happened in Afghanistan since 9/11? What were the claims? And then what did you find?
Sure. Okay. The horrible tragedy of 9/11 happens. The Bush administration links the attacks to al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, and then unilaterally, remember, without U.N. sanction, goes in to invade and topple the Taliban regime, who had been giving sanctuary to Osama bin Laden. And the justification was is it's the fight against terrorism. And if we get rid of Taliban and we kill Osama bin Laden, that will deal a very significant blow to the terrorists who attacked the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. That was the argument. Now, indeed, the Taliban was a very repressive, hated government in Afghanistan. Nobody was sorry to see it go. But as is always the case, the immediate military victory against a impoverished, weak military force is much easier to take care of than to run the country after the war is over. And what exactly kind of government is going to replace the Taliban? Well, the U.S. never got that far, or they thought they did, but as usual, horribly miscalculated. So the U.S. goes in, topples the Taliban, scatters the al-Qaeda forces to the hills and the mountainous areas and the border areas with Pakistan. Osama bin Laden, remember him, by the way? Remember
vaguely.
That name ring any bells? Yeah, Osama bin Laden.
Didn't he move to Iraq? We've lost our guest, apparently. I apologize to our listeners. We've been disconnected. We're going to try to get him back on the line. I apologize for that. For those of you who are listening, wondering what this 30-second conspicuous silence was, I think it came up when our guest, Reese Ehrlich, mentioned Osama bin Laden, so you can draw your own conclusions. At any rate, my name is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters today on WILL. AM 580 here in Urbana, and our guest is Reese Ehrlich, the longtime foreign correspondent and journalist who is an expert on U.S. Foreign policy and the coverage of U.S. foreign policy, who's traveled. Right. Are you back with us, Reese?
Yes, I think it's when I noticed the phone went dead when I said Osama bin Laden.
I did notice that, yes.
I'm sure it was coincidence. Anyway, where were we? So we're talking about Afghanistan. And the so we toppled the regime. The Osama bin Laden forces and some of the Taliban leadership go into hiding. And then we proclaim victory. And I suspect that most people in this country think that Afghanistan is either now a democracy or making steady progress towards becoming a democracy. Well, nothing could be farther than the truth. It was obvious when I was there in January of last year. It was obvious to anybody who's been there since then. Hamid Karzai, the U.S.-appointed leader, remember, there have been no elections in Afghanistan, no elections in a democratic sense that we would anybody would recognize. Hamid Karzai, the appointed leader from the United States, is the president of the city of Kabul, and that's it. He has no control outside of Kabul. You can't even drive on the road from Kabul to Kandahar. And finally, the New York Times got around to admitting this in yesterday's front-page article in yesterday's paper, some 18 months after the fact. But it was a very interesting article nonetheless because they pointed out things like the major U.S. aid effort was to rebuild the road from Kabul to Kandahar, one of the other major cities. And there's absolutely no construction going on. The road is still not passable, and there's no work going on. So the U.S. efforts to bring any kind of stability to Afghanistan are a complete failure. You've got a series of warlords running the country, the U.S. dealing with some of them and buying some off and fighting some others. U.S. soldiers are getting regularly attacked in Afghanistan, an average of one rocket attack a day. A couple of U.S. soldiers just got killed in the last few days. It is chaos. There's no security. There's no government, let alone anything approaching democracy. Yes, there's been some small steps of progress, including women being able to go to school, girls being able to go to school in Kabul, but not outside of Kabul. So there's this basically been a blackout in the U.S. media about any developments that have gone on in Afghanistan because the situation is so bad.
What about the al-Qaeda network? I mean, if the cause of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan or the reason for it was to take them out or neutralize them or eliminate them or at least lessen their influence, has that been a success at least?
Well, I think certainly al-Qaeda was dealt a setback. I don't think it was the best way to go about it, but objectively, sure, because they've been forced out of a situation where they were given sanctuary by a government, and now they're in the hills. But, you look at things like the Bali bombing and various other things that have happened, terrorist attacks, have not stopped as a result of the U.S. attack. And it shows the myth that you don't combat terrorism by invading entire countries, toppling governments, and occupying them. You deal with terrorism by police and judicial action. You go after the perpetrators of the crimes. You take whatever police action is appropriate. You arrest them, you put them on trial, and you isolate them politically. That's the only way you can fight terrorism. You can't do it by setting up new military bases everywhere you go, because you just become a target for new attacks. And the people of Afghanistan are growing increasingly angry at the U.S., and we're going to see this, we're already seeing it in Iraq already.
Well, that really leads to the crucial question, which is the aftermath of the takeover of Iraq and the elimination of the Saddam Hussein government. What's going on there now, and what should we anticipate happening? And then finally, how's the press covering it?
Yeah. Well, everything that's going on in Iraq was completely predictable. You can read our book, Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. And in it, I talk, in one of the chapters I wrote about, I talk about the situation with the Shias in the south, and that the danger in Iraq is that you have competing religious and ethnic factions, and that once Saddam Hussein is toppled, the U.S. is then responsible for holding the country together and combating the various trends. And now everything that goes on in Iraq is the U.S.'s responsibility. It can no longer say, oh, horrible, horrible Saddam Hussein, he did everything wrong. Now the U.S. has to resolve the same problems that Saddam faced. And the Shia, the Shias make up some 60% of the Iraqi population. They have been horribly repressed under Saddam Hussein. They also happen to, there's a section of them strongly, with a strong right-wing fundamentalist bent, supported by the right-wing fundamentalist mullahs in Iran. And the U.S. is now faced front and center with, what are you going to do with these folks? Because if you have democratic elections, the wrong people might win. So, you know, that's the problem with
democracy. And that is also one of the other great claims that was used to explain the need for overthrowing the Saddam Hussein regime, publicly presented to the United States, was the need to get rid of this vile government and replace it with a Western-style liberal democracy with free elections.
And there's no way, frankly, even the State Department knew that was a phony claim, because they published a document to that effect. I mean, that was right up there with weapons of mass destruction, one of the phoniest claims the U.S. ever made. I can guarantee you, and I'll be happy to talk to you in 6 months or a year, there will be no democracy in Iraq. There will be either a pro-U.S. Regime installed, friendly to the U.S., either through just forgetting about elections altogether or through manipulated elections, or there's going to be a chaotic situation in which the U.S. ultimately is forced out and some kind of a government hostile to the United States comes in. There is no way that the U.S. will allow genuine free and fair elections, genuine free and fair opposition press. I mean, is the U.S. going to allow a daily newspaper or radio station that regularly criticizes the U.S. takeover of the Iraqi oil industry or the calling for the elimination of U.S. military bases in Iraq? I don't think so. We're not interested in democracy in Iraq. We're interested in controlling the geopolitical region and controlling the oil fields and a whole lot of other stuff that has nothing to do with democracy.
We're talking to Reese Ehrlich today in Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney, your host. We'd welcome your phone calls if you'd like to call in and speak with Reese Ehrlich, the co-author with Norman Solomon of Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, and a 35-year veteran journalist. The number here at Media Matters is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. We have some lines open, but let's go to the phone lines right now. Champagne, you're on the air with Reese Ehrlich.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, on September 11th, everybody started asking the question, why do they hate us? And then, we don't seem to have made very good plans for winning the peace. And so it seems that, everybody's going to hate us even more. If, the place just descends into total chaos or, totalitarianism or whatever. But this almost seems irrational. Is it that people are completely blind, or they just have an ideology that they believe over the facts? Or, it really It doesn't seem to make sense.
When you ask, are they blind, you're talking about officials of the U.S. government?
I'm talking about people like Rumsfeld.
I think they wear blinders. They wear ideological blinders that allow them only to see certain things. So you have Richard Perle and Rumsfeld and Paul Wolfowitz, and these are intelligent people. They're not stupid, and they've got access to the most massive databases in the world. You know, they are convinced that in a short form that the U.S. is the greatest country in the world, that we have to export our model of free markets and political pluralism, and that the way to do that, the best way to do that, of course, is to pressure other countries into doing it, but if it takes an invasion, so be it, and that somehow you can implant this free market so-called democratic system onto other countries, and that little things like, well, what would happen, what power would these right-wing fundamentalist Shia clerics have in Iraq? Well, that doesn't enter into it because the Iraqi people will rise up as one to welcome us as liberators. I mean, they really believe that stuff. And I have quotes from them prior to the war where saying they were, you know, the U.S. soldiers were going to be welcomed with flowers. Well, that is so far out of reality, it's hard to believe that they actually believe that, but they do. And now they're still pushing the thing. Well, we won the war, we toppled Saddam Hussein, so we're okay. And then they're hoping people will ignore the aftermath, just as they've been able to do in Afghanistan.
And also, has there been any real kind of proof or evidence of who was responsible for looting the museums? Was it Ba'athists, former Ba'athists, Fedayeen, Al Qaeda, Mafia?
I have not seen any proof of it. There have been reports that it was an inside job, that some of the vaults were opened with keys rather than blown, and that there were selective items taken that were quite valuable, so somebody had to know, with some background, had to know that. But there's all kinds of wild speculation as to who that might be. I certainly don't know.
Thank you.
All right, we're talking to Reese Ehrlich today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. If you'd like to call in and ask Reese Ehrlich a question, the number 333-9455, the toll-free number 800-222-9455. Reese Ehrlich is the co-author with Norman Solomon of Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, and a journalist for 35 years covering foreign affairs extensively. Reese, one of the big stories of this war and the media coverage of it was the idea of the embedded reporters. It was sort of the main way the war was covered. Well, what was your sense of the embedded reporter program? Was it a success from the vantage point of the public or a failure?
Oh, I think it was a failure from the standpoint of the public. I think it was a great success from the standpoint of the Pentagon. They took a calculated risk. I think they figured that they could rely on the pro-war sentiments, the patriotism, and their ability to pressure the media so that if they sent people out embedded with the troops, that they would get largely favorable coverage. And so long as the war was going well from a U.S. standpoint, that they would get favorable coverage. And, of course, that's exactly what happened. For one thing, I mean, people sometimes ask me, would I have been an embedded reporter? My answer is no. And it's not mainly because of the danger or the hardships, mainly because you're limited to have one source. You're the soldiers around you, the officers around you are the sole source of information. So you're like the frog in the well. And whatever is happening in that particular battle or with that particular company, that's what you report. Now, occasionally, where there was some good reporting is when the embedded reporters actually interacted with Iraqi civilians or were there when military incidents took place, and then they could report firsthand and not get it second or third hand from the Pentagon briefers in Doha. And one of the more interesting stories was, do you remember that van of some 10 Iraqi women and children were shot at because they didn't stop at a checkpoint allegedly?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
The Pentagon version of the story was that they fired warning shots and the van kept coming and then they had to fire. Well, the Washington Post had a very interesting story reported from the scene that said they hadn't fired warning shots and that the soldiers panicked because they were worried about suicide bombers. So,
yeah, I missed that on the Fox News channel. They must not have picked up that part of the story.
You know, I mean, otherwise, Fox is so great, right? I don't know how they missed that one.
Yeah.
Like having Target Iraq, Iraqi Freedom is their Operation Iraqi Freedom is their slogan, which just by coincidence happens to be the same one as the Pentagon. So that was a very interesting Washington Post story, and which, by the way, fell off the charts immediately. There was no follow-up from any other newspaper or any other media that I've ever seen following up to find out exactly what happened. And that, in general, is going to be the case. The glories of the U.S. Military will be proclaimed from banner headlines, but the atrocities against civilians, the mistakes, the shooting up of the Palestine Hotel and killing of journalists, the sending of a cruise missile into the Al Jazeera office when they knew exactly where the Al Jazeera office was, none of that is going to get much play by the mainstream media.
We're talking to Reese Ehrlich today on Media Matters. We've got phone lines open at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. Next week on Media Matters, we'll have as our guest Matthew Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine based out of Madison, Wisconsin. This is our Editor's Month coming up 2 weeks from today. Our guest will be Katrina Vandenhoevel, the editor of The Nation magazine. And then 3 weeks from today, May 18th, our guest will be Dean Baker, a leading media economist, talking about a range of issues dealing with how media markets work. And he's one of the really smartest and most informed economic analyst of media. So I urge you all to be tuned in for the next 3 weeks. Let's go back to the phone lines right now if we can. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Reese Ehrlich.
Hi. Well, first of all, thank you for the excellent program and excellent guest. It helps some of us out here feel like we're not totally alone, which at this point can sometimes be an issue. I have two quick questions. One was, in fact, isn't a lot of what's happening here pretty much right along the line of the article that Cheney et al. Put together in their blueprint 10, 11 years ago, one, and two, are you having a lot of media folks ask you for interviews? In other words, are you being able to get information out, or are people not even too interested in hearing that? And I would hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right, Reese?
Sure. Yeah, I think you're referring to the documents from about 97 with the right-wing think tank with Wolfowitz, Pearl, and company.
That's right.
Basically they've been advocating an invasion of Iraq since the late 90s, mid-90s. They tried to get Clinton to do it. He wouldn't go along with it. They tried to get Bush to do it when he got elected, and he wouldn't go along with it initially. So, yes, they've been advocating this policy, and it's pretty clearly spelled out in their documents. That doesn't mean there was a conspiracy. It means that they were strong advocates for this viewpoint and basically couldn't get anybody to go along with it until after 9/11. And then after 9/11, the Bush administration has skillfully manipulated public opinion to basically justify anything. And so Iraq, which had absolutely nothing to do with 9/11, was suddenly becomes the enemy. And God knows, maybe North Korea will find the North Korea connection to 9/11 and grounds for invading them. Who knows? In terms of media, it's very, very interesting. Norman Solomon, my co-author, and myself, we have been interviewed a lot. It's interesting the pattern to it. Norman and myself were on MSNBC. He was on CNN six different times in the lead-up to the war. Once the day before the war started, all the national networks stopped calling. CNN didn't call him, or me didn't call, MSNBC and Fox News didn't call.
How about the Baseball Hall of Fame?
Oh, you knew about my connection with that film. No, they didn't call either. Now, we did get a lot of calls from foreign media. There was just this huge influx of all the major media from abroad, BBC, CBC, Australian radio. They were very interested in our viewpoint, not coincidentally. And regional media, I have to say, some NPR stations, some AM talk, including conservative talk radio, but these were no longer on the national level, by and large. They were regional or local shows. And I think what it illustrates, and by the way, Norman has been frozen from any of the national cable TV shows up until yesterday when he appeared for the first time again on Fox News, interestingly enough.
All right.
So I think what it reflects is what we talk about is the parameters of coverage. In other words, up until the war started, it was considered okay to have critics of the war. Once the war started, it would be unpatriotic to have strong and articulate critics of the war. So you have former and current military generals and former and current Navy SEALs and Green Berets. Now that the war is over, there's some obvious problems with the what's going on with the Shias not rising up against Saddam Hussein, but rising up against the United States. Now the anti-war perspective is a bit more legitimate again, and we may well be getting more calls. So it's like I said, it's, the parameters are not fixed. They, in some to some degree, change with the changing reality. But the idea that we have a free press that will offer different viewpoints is so much hokum, as exampled by what I just described.
We're talking to Reese Ehrlich today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Our phone lines, we've got a couple openings if you want to call in at 333-9455. Toll-free number 800-222-9455. Let's get back to the phone lines now. We'll get to everyone who calls in. Line 2, Champagne, you're on the air with Reese Ehrlich.
Hi, yeah. I was wondering what your thoughts are about what we in the public can do, I guess, to change the what seems to me the bias in the media coverage of this war and, I guess, just this administration in general. I mean, is it worth anything? Does it do anything? I mean, to write letters to the editor or to write them letters and say, I'm not going to read your newspaper, I'm not going to watch your TV show, or, you know, or should we just go to, you know, foreign media sources to get a more balanced view on things, or what can we do to change the way
they're
that the...
Very, very good questions. Yes, first, become a informed media consumer and media activist. So the first part is to seek out alternative viewpoints. You expressed the thing a lot of people are doing, which is to go to the British press, or if you read French or German, go check out their press. And you're likely to get very different coverage of the very same events that so gets so distorted here. And there's a number of websites that will send you emails every day with compendiums of articles from other media, either from the U.S. mainstream media or from the British or French press.
Could you recommend one or two, Reese?
Sure. I find it very helpful. That way I don't have to try and read The Guardian every day in London or The Independent in London. Truthout.org. That's truthout, one word, .org. Sign up for free. They'll give you 7, 8, 9 articles a day that are worth checking out. Commondreams.org is another good one. Alternet.org is the wire service of the alternative newspapers, and they've been having a lot of interesting articles about Iraq and about domestic issues, the repression at home, of violations of civil liberties, and so on. So all of those are good. Znet.org is another one. Then the other thing you can do is it really does make a difference if you get in touch with your local media. I think you have less impact on the national media, a lot more on your local media. So if you see a story on the local TV station or in your local newspaper that is particularly bad, write in a few paragraphs, either email, letter, or even a phone call, complaining about it. And, you know, most news stories get no comments whatsoever. The editors, I write a lot for the mainstream media. Most of my stories go out there, and there is a zip reaction. If you get 5 letters on a story, that's considered a upsurge in mass public opinion. And similarly, if you see an article that's good, it's important to write in letters of support because those reporters may be out on a limb, and it's very nice to hear from the public. Don't do the kind of mass emails or email petitions. Those are useless. But a heartfelt, honestly written individual letter or email can do some good. And then, you know, if there's a particularly egregious media, local media, you can start think about organizing advertiser boycotts or subscription boycotts. They can be effective if they hit a certain critical mass. You know, if you can get enough outrage in the community, they will listen to that because that's the source of their funds.
We've got Reese Ehrlich, our guest today in Media Matters. We've got a full bank of phone lines. If you're waiting to get through to Reese Ehrlich, please be patient. We will get to you. Line 3, you're on the air with Reese Ehrlich.
Oh, great. Can you put those web links or those email addresses
on your home site or something?
Yeah, what we'll do, actually, we'll put it on our Media Matters weekly mailing we send out to all our listeners. So if anyone wants to get that weekly mailing, just email my producer, Ben Scott, at dbscott@uiuc.edu. And we'll have all those links put up the next time we send one out, in the next couple of weeks. So if you don't sign up right away, you'll make sure you get it. Do you have a question for Reese Ehrlich?
Actually, I do. Came across a couple of interesting views of that statue being pulled down in Baghdad, saying it was a media event. Most of it was centered on the fact that there are very few people in the square and it was just a media event. However, a couple of reports pointed out or stated things that I haven't been able to double-check, and I was wondering how I can go about doing that. One of them said the Iraqi flag used was not the current flag, but the flag from like 30 years ago, and wondered where they got that. And the other was that the American flag used was the one from the Pentagon, and there were no sources listed for either of those. I'm wondering how I can verify the veracity of either of those claims.
Yeah, I don't know the answers to your specific questions. If I were trying to check it out, I guess I'd do a Google search or try some of the foreign media who are more likely to report that. I'm sure that's not reported anywhere in the U.S. media, or at least I certainly haven't seen it. I did talk with someone who was watching Greek television about that particular incident. There were a number of times when the statue was pulled down, by the way, and there is absolutely no question that these were made for the media events. These were not spontaneous happenings, as in fact did happen in Eastern Europe or in Berlin, for example. They were trying to model it after that. It was a case where the U.S. tanks or vehicles pull up, threw a chain around the statue, pulled it down. According to this, my friend who saw it on Greek TV, they showed a wider shot, and the U.S. soldiers were encouraging Iraqis to get involved in, you know, attacking the statue and so on, and that there were larger numbers of people just sitting around with their arms folded, not doing anything. So it was an attempt on numerous occasions to show the popular upsurge of support for the United States. I'm sure there were some Iraqis who did welcome the U.S. They hated Saddam Hussein and figured, hey, well, this is good. A lot of the same people said, well, thank you very much for helping us get rid of Saddam Hussein. Now go home. And that part of it does not get the same media attention that the manufactured media events did.
Okay, we're talking to Reese Ehrlich. We do have one line open. We're going to get to all the callers who do call in. Line 4, Chicago, you're on the air with Reese Ehrlich.
Hello, thanks for a good program. Back here at home, the consuming public, the North American public, what are some solutions to the problem that when we grow up and we attend school, we're not learning about how the world works the way people around the world seem to be learning, so that when something happens, we have a base to judge the kind of reporting we're getting. And by the time people are adults, they're far more distracted by other things. They know a lot more baseball statistics than they do about economic statistics and country statistics.
You make an excellent point, and I think we need to make some serious changes in our education system. I'd be real happy if people would start identifying Iraq on a map. That might be an interesting first step. I think it's not coincidence. That is, if you go back certainly to the 80s with the Reagan administration, they consciously withheld money from education, federal monies that would go to the states and the cities and so on for education, and spent it on what? The war with the Contras and build, the missile buildup with the Soviet Union. And that has basically continued under Democrats and Republicans ever since, although Clinton tried to make some small reversals. Basically, there's been less money, less genuine emphasis on education, and we see the results. But frankly, to change it, I think it ain't going to come from the government. It's not going to come from the top, from top-level Democrats or Republicans. I think we need a grassroots efforts of teachers and parents and students who want to see a change in the education system and do it at the school level. There are decent textbooks out there. There are curricula that will give a different view about U.S. history and about U.S. foreign policy. And I think it's important that that get adopted. And the only way that's going to happen is through grassroots activism.
You know, Reese, when you watch our mainstream television news channels, the cable channels, and I think most of our U.S. journalism, the premise, and certainly I think it's a widespread belief among many Americans, is that the United States is a benevolent power in the world out to do good. And basically the rest of the world is a highly suspicious place occupied by governments and nations that are not out to do good. And we're riding the white horse, so to speak. And this is sort of the starting point, the accepted antitude mission to debate. And it seems that this is what the caller is getting at to some extent, that ignorance sort of makes it possible for people to assume an uncritical stance toward their own nation. What, from your experience, I mean, what would you say that most Americans are unaware of about how the U.S. is seen around the world and the role the U.S. plays in the world?
Yeah, I think, I mean, when you're on the receiving end of the U.S. benevolence, you have a very different view than sitting here in the U.S. Completely detached from it. I don't know if, you know, and I think your point is well taken, because even people who, some people who oppose the war, I've talked with them, and they say, well, look, the war wasn't right, but at least we got rid of Saddam Hussein, and they can have democracy. The point being is that, in reality, the U.S. has never promoted democracy in any third-world country, and certainly not since the end of World War II. If we were so interested in promoting democracy in the Middle East, how come there aren't any Arab countries that are allied with the U.S. that have anything close to democracy? Whether it be Egypt or Saudi Arabia or any of the Gulf states, you know, these are all various forms of autocracies that the U.S. is perfectly happy to get along with, so long as they keep the oil flowing and side with the U.S. on a variety of issues. So I think part of it, you know, during the Vietnam War era, people began to understand the U.S. and what the U.S. wasn't the benevolent power that it claimed to be. You know, there were lots of verified reports of torture, of incredible human rights violations. I think that information is still out there. You know, the U.S. is systematically torturing people in Afghanistan. It's front page news on the New York Times. Except it goes out there, the story dies, because there's nobody in the Democratic Party who's willing to make that into a significant issue. Whereas the calls for congressional hearings to investigate under what grounds can the U.S. now be systematically torturing people and as part of official policy. You know, I mean, I would think there would be outrage about that. There's not. And I think we saw a huge grassroots movement in opposition to the war, the biggest and the widest that this country has seen for that period in the approach up to war. I think that movement is somewhat in decline now, as inevitably will happen once the perception is that the U.S. won the war. But I think it will be growing again as the events in Iraq don't go the way the U.S. plans, and as the economy gets worse and worse as a result of spending all that money in Iraq with nobody else paying for it. And I think come 2004, we're going to see a huge dump Bush movement that's going to grow, and sectors of the anti-war movement are going to be going into that.
Now, in the news media in the last month or two, one of the big stories has been the unwillingness of our traditional allies, the United States traditional allies, specifically France, to go along with the U.S. action, the invasion of Iraq, and support it. And France has come under withering attack in our news media. The Fox News Channel has led an informal boycott of French products, or at least some of their announcers have. William Safire in the New York Times has been questioning them. And the argument goes basically that France is being highly opportunistic, that they just want to sort of run Iraq for their own naked self-interest, and the U.S. is being the principled party here.
Isn't that an ironic argument?
Yeah, I mean, how does it look if you're in France? I mean, is it a case of French opportunism versus principled American behavior and concern for democracy and peace?
I guess a couple points on that. Do the French have commercial economic interests? Of course they do. But it's not anything like the U.S. has been characterizing. It's interesting how the U.S. is always willing to call the kettle black and say, oh, the French wanted their oil contracts, but the U.S. has no interest in oil in Iraq. You know, it's pure hypocrisy. Ironically, if the French really all they were interested in was the oil, they would have gone along with the U.S. because it was obvious that the victors were going to divvy up the spoils and get the various contracts with the Iraqi oil fields. By opposing the U.S., the French virtually guaranteed that they'd have no say in the future oil development of Iraq. So if they were acting strictly out of commercial interest, they would have sided with the U.S. I think the U.S., you know, the other point that's worth noting is that all of this anti-French sentiment that's being whipped up in this country is directly coming out of the White House and Karl Rove. They figured that, I have to ask yourself, how come it's all anti-French and not anti-German? If anything, the Germans would be easier to pillory, you know, a bunch of Nazis, what do they know about opposing war, blah, blah, blah. It was a very conscious political manipulation of the American public because France had the veto power in the Security Council. Germany did not. So you go after France, you try and back them off from exercising their veto by vilifying them, by distorting history, by claiming, oh, my God, look how ungrateful they are after we rescued them. Hello, you know, in World War II, you know, hello, read your history books. You know, it's the most cynical, nationalistic, jingoistic kinds of political manipulation. It's reminiscent of what these evil politicians did in Yugoslavia to whip up hatred against other ethnic groups in order to keep themselves in power. And it's going to come back to bite the Bush administration. You know, and the French so far are not buckling. I mean, they're now saying, okay, before we lift the sanctions, let's make sure that there's no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. So let's send back in the inspectors so they can verify it. The U.S. was horrified. My God, what are you talking about? You know, what if we don't find them? We may not be able to control the oil field. I mean, the U.S., it's a perfectly consistent position, actually, and the U.S. is horrified by it and putting tremendous pressure on France to try and rescind it.
We're talking to Rhys Ehrlich, our guest today in Media Matters. We only have a few minutes left, and we're going to get to both the callers who have been waiting patiently. So let's go right there to the phone lines. Line 1, Bourbonnais, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thank you for being so patient.
I'm a Gulf War vet, and my brother died on USS Cole. I was wondering, how many slaps in the face do you have to get to do something?
Okay, legitimate question. You know, if I thought that Saddam Hussein had anything to do with 9/11, we would be having a very different discussion here. But Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi government were no threat to the people of the United States since the end, certainly at least since the end of 91, when his government was defeated, was forced to withdraw from Kuwait. And we can have a discussion whether he was really a threat to the United States back then, but for sure there's no question that he had a weakened power. He had no weapons of mass destruction that could be used as actual weapons, as we're now finding out. He had absolutely no connections to the terrorists who conducted the 9/11 attacks. So it's I feel for you because there are Americans who have been killed, who have been victims of whether terrorist attacks or various wars. But what the U.S. is doing is having the exact opposite effect of what the Bush administration claims. We're doing nothing to stop terrorism and everything to help these nutcases have more political recruits, because now they can point to the horrible American imperialist monster who is now occupying new Arab and Muslim lands. You know, the U.S. is going to now have 4 military bases in Iraq. You know, so much for the idea that we're bringing peace, stability, and democracy to the country. So the actual impact, you know, there's going to be new terrorist bombings, there's going to be new attacks as a direct result of the Bush policy. We're not going to be any safer here as a result. And the lives of the people who have, you know, died in the fields as U.S. soldiers, all we're going to see is more American soldiers killed in Iraq trying to defend the, you know, trying to unwind the chaos that the U.S. has brought.
Is there a certain irony in the fact that the people proceeding with the war and pushing it in Washington are people themselves who all basically did everything in their power to avoid serving in military themselves during the 1960s?
Yeah, it is my
it is with great irony that, you know, the issue that Clinton had avoided the draft was, oh, my God, the right wing was outraged about that. But the fact that George Bush was manipulated, got himself into the National Guard, and then went AWOL for a number of months, they couldn't even find him when he was supposed to be assigned to his unit, and that none of the leading, they're called chicken hawks, right? None of them served time in the military. It's highly ironic. It's you know what it's much like to me is that the religious right who supports all these right wing Republicans, a number of whom haven't set foot in church for years, who have multiple divorces and don't exactly have the best family values. But it really doesn't matter. So long as you support an aggressive policy, it doesn't matter what you do in your personal life.
Well, let's go back to our final caller. It's been very patient. Line 2, Champaign County. You're on the air with Reese Ehrlich.
Hi. Good afternoon. I was going to call up and ask about the dissension in the intelligentsia, as it were, and you sort of touched upon it when you were, if there is such a thing, you touched upon whether the Democrats are actually going to make any objections. But I was struck by the fact that on Fox News they did a completely, you know, okay interview with Ahmed Chalabi today, and then on NBC they're asking him, the ambassador from Jordan, you know, how big of a crook is this guy really? Because, you know, he apparently is involved in the failure of 3 banks, one in Switzerland, one in Jordan, and one in Lebanon as well, apparently. So how much dissension is there? And, you know, this is how much are we expecting to see more of this? I hope you get more calls, because this has been a great hour. But the other thing I wanted to ask, and I guess there's no time really to comment, but I'd heard just yesterday on alternative radio that supposedly Bush had no idea of the Sunnis and the Shiites, had no idea of distinction, and Wolfowitz, who is vaunted as some kind of expert in the area, was quoted somewhere as saying that, no, the Shiites don't have any major holy places in Iraq, whereas...
Well, that'd be pretty amazing.
Okay,
I'd love to see that, and if you can verify that, because some of the holiest sites of the Shia religion are in Iraq. I visited them.
Well, why don't you go ahead and respond to the first part of this question?
Sure. Yes, I think actually there's going to be a lot of dissension on Ahmed Chalabi. He's the leader of the Iraqi National Congress. He's the guy that the Pentagon and these right-wing ideologues like Wolfowitz and Pearl are pushing to take over the government in Iraq. But he's lost the confidence of much of the White House and the Pentagon. There's a lot of battling going on. I mean, among other things, the guy was convicted of bank fraud in Jordan. He's a wanted man. And here we're going to go install him as the president of Iraq. I mean, it's just bizarre, folks. Absolutely incredible. Not to mention the fact that he doesn't have any support in the country. And he's going to have to introduce it at the point of a gun with the U.S. military and his armed guerrillas, who've already been found guilty, I mean, have been found looting in Iraq. The Iraqis who came in with Chalabi were, in some cases, detained by U.S. soldiers for looting. Great, great start, huh, folks? But I think they are appallingly... I think what happened is one of the reasons they didn't understand the power of the Shia clerics is that Chalabi is himself a Shia. And so they thought, okay, we've got that box checked, and now let's go off to the Kurds and all these other things. They have no understanding of the internal dynamics in the Shia community, and it takes more than just somebody who hadn't been in the country since 1958 to bring him in and say he's a Shia, and that takes care of that.
Thank you very much. I want to thank Reese Ehrlich for being our guest today on Media Matters. Reese, do you have any closing comments you'd like to make?
Well, I think I guess I would just encourage people to read the mainstream media critically. I read the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and numbers of Christian Science Monitor every day. I think it's important that you read the media, just learn to read between the lines, and, of course, you know, continue to check out alternative media. Community radio is an important asset. Listen to it, get the information you can from there as well as from the Internet.
Well, thank you very much, Reese Ehrlich, for being our guest today on Media Matters, co-author of Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. I want to thank you all for joining us. I want to thank my producer, Ben Scott, and see you 167 hours with Matt Rothschild.